In the garage of Dr. Frank Conrad, on November 2nd, 1920, the first scheduled pre-advertised radio program in the United States went on the air. Station KDKA was broadcasting returns of the presidential race on the evening of Election Day. From a humble beginning in a Pittsburgh garage to the sumptuous studios of the national radio networks in New York, Chicago, and Hollywood, these are the years we refer to as the golden age of radio.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing it yourself.
Al Kemp, on the air for Griffin.
It's time to shine, shine your shoes anyway.
Tony Home Permanent presents...
This is Nora Drake.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, serving Central Connecticut since 1889. We'll join hosts Dick Bertel and Ed Corcoran and meet their special guest, Parker Fennelly, after these words from Burritt Mutual Savings Bank.
Do you want to get rich? Rich, you say? Who doesn't? Well, here's how. Save a little each payday, and do it where little deposits are welcome, at the Big B, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. A small sum saved regularly will accumulate astoundingly fast. Hard work, frugal living, regular saving, all old-fashioned virtues, but the only sure way to succeed, even to become rich. The place to save before you spend, the Big B. The big, strong bank built on faithful small deposits from loyal depositors. Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. Four convenient offices, New Britain, West Hartford, and on the border of Rocky Hill and Wethersfield. Don't wait. Start saving small or big now.
Member of FDIC. Now the host of the Golden Age of Radio, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me once again is the man with 2,500 hours of old-time radio memories on tape, Ed Corcoran. Ed, this setting that we're in tonight seems rather familiar.
Yes, we're not in the sumptuous studios of WTIC, Dick. We're out on location in one of the most famous areas in radio, Allen's Alley. You remember that at all?
As a matter of fact, I do, and as long as we're in Allen's Alley, suppose we knock on this door here.
Howdy, Bob.
That's the familiar voice of Titus Moody, the character on Allen's Alley, portrayed by Parker Fennelly, our guest this month on the Golden Age of Radio. Parker, it's a pleasure to welcome you to our show.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be on it.
We're going to explore your career, which covers many years. You're familiar, of course, to radio audiences today because of your association with Pepperidge Farm Bread. How long have you been spokesman for them?
Radio and television, I think this is the 19th year, maybe 20th.
That's a long association with one sponsor.
Yes, I sometimes say I'm a man who lives by bread alone.
If I had that line, I'd sometimes say it too. Ed, I wonder if perhaps this is the first time that our radio audience, at least, has heard the voice of Parker Fennelly as it actually sounds.
Yes, in all my recollections and the shows that I have, it's a different Parker Fennelly, more like Hiram Neville, I remember him, or Titus Moody. I was really surprised when he didn't sound like that in real life.
Well, many years ago, I was out in South Dakota, and I was in a small town, and a man drove me, I guess it must have been in an early Ford, across the country to some other town, and he asked me where I came from. And I told him I was born in Maine, and he said, I knew you were a foreigner by the way you talk.
Well, let's go back to the very beginnings in Maine. That's where you were born and grew up. And what decided you to embark upon a theatrical career?
I was thinking the other day that I remembered way back when I was young, I had two ideas about what I would do when I got grown up. One was to be an actor, and the other was to be a barber. I don't know just how that barber crept in, but as it turned out, with all the hair around and the lack of business for barbers, I probably picked the right one.
I would say. And what steps did you take to ensure that you had...
Well, after I got out of high school, I went to Leland Powers School in Boston. And then I went out. I don't suppose you are old enough to remember, but in the old days, there used to be a thing called Chautauqua.
Mm-hmm.
In the winter, there were a series of lectures or musical artists giving entertainments or different things of that kind. And that was called Lyceum. They were called Lyceum courses. And in the summer, under big tents, there was something called Chautauqua. And they had celebrated people on, like, for instance, I traveled with Maurice Hindus, who died a while ago, and his book was published just the other day after his death, and Brian, and...
You were talking about William Jennings Bryan?
That's right, so you see how far I go back. But anyhow, I went out first on Chautauqua with a Shakespeare company, playing Twelfth Night, and eventually Taming of the Shrew, and then from that I went to star companies throughout the country, and quite a number, and I didn't get to Broadway for a long time, but I finally got to Broadway with Walter Houston in a play called Mr. Pitt.
Now, did all of this precede your career in radio?
Yes, it does. I was with Frank Keenan in Chicago with a play called Black Velvet, and I came back from Chicago at the end of the summer season, and I met one of the actors on Broadway, and he told me they were having auditions over at NBC for radio. I had done a little in Washington and in Philadelphia, but not commercially. So I went over, and I got a part in a series called Fires of Men, sponsored by some furnace company, I think. Anyhow, but that led to my working in Snow Village, which was then called Sconeyland Sketches,
yes.
Sponsored by Sconey, naturally. And at that time, the Sconeyland Sketches comprised, I'll say, two historical sketches, half hour each, and one rural sketch, generally laid, I think, in a little town called Snow Village in New Hampshire. The rural sketches, as I believe, were so popular with the audiences that they eventually discarded the historical sketches, and we did Snow Village sketches week after week, and I think I'm right in saying that we were on 19 seasons, not every week, of course, through 19 years, we did the same sketches.
Well, we're going to go back to Snow Village right after this message.
Get smile power, the kind of confident, contented countenance that comes from cash, salted away cash, in a Burritt Mutual savings bank at the highest legal savings bank interest rate. And you don't need a lot of money to do it. You can save a little. It's the constant, patient, every payday habit of saving that really counts. At the Big B, we love your small deposits. We know they grow for you and for us. Result, we will both have smile power. Plus, we help with our high interest rates paid to you on your savings. Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. Deposits insured to $20,000 by FDIC.
Parker Fenley is our guest tonight. We're recording the Golden Age of Radio at his Peekskill, New York home. Ed, I assume that your collection includes the Snow Village sketches.
Yes, this was really one of my most prized programs because it's one of the first I remember, and I liked it a great deal. And the characters, to me, typified New England perhaps more so than any other show that was ever done. And maybe we ought to play one just to show everybody what a great show this was. This is with Daniel Dickey and his wife and Hiram Neville.
Parker, have you had the opportunity to hear any of these old transcriptions, or will this be the first time for you?
I haven't heard a Snow Village sketch ever, I believe, since we did them.
Well, this will be a first.
The Mutual Broadcasting System presents Snow Village Sketches with author Allen and Parker Fenley. The Chronicle of Snow Village, which we're about to bring you, took place during that period in Hiram Neville's life when he had ceased living as a bachelor and had taken unto himself a wife, the widow of the late Samuel Finch. Effie, for that was her name, was a good cook, and this fact may have had more than a little to do with Hiram giving up the freedom of single blessedness to open his heart and his home to a wife. It was a sunny June morning. The road leading by Hiram's farm had had no passers-by. For an hour now, Hiram had been out working on his peas, which were already in blossom. But this situation was altered by the arrival of a horse and buggy. The horse was going slowly in a shuffling walk, kicking up the loose sand. There were two people in the buggy, Dan'l Dickey and his wife Hattie. In spite of the heat, Dan'l was dressed in his black suit, and Hattie wore her black silk. They did not speak. There was about their slow progress a definite solemnity. As they came in view of Hiram's house and saw his bent figure stooping over, pulling out witch grass, Dan'l called to the horse.
Whoa! Whoa there!
What's the matter, Dan'l?
I want to see Hiram.
Oh, not now, Dan'l. We got to get up there to the Willises.
Wait a minute. Hiram!
Yeah? Who is it?
Dan'l! Can I see you a minute?
Oh, Dan'l, don't you stand and talk. I got to get this visit to the Willises over and get home again.
Hattie, did you ever think he may want to come with us?
In them work clothes?
Hattie, we could wait. It wouldn't take him a minute to change.
Well, where are you going all dressed up? Hey, Godfrey, you look like you was going to preach somewheres. So you're awful solemn. A pair of you.
Hiram, we're going up to Charles's.
Oh, yes, of course. Say, he died awful sudden, didn't he?
Yeah.
I ought to know that was where you was headed, dressed like this.
Yeah, well, we wondered, would you like to come along with us, Hiram?
Me?
Yeah.
I couldn't leave off work now.
Well, Hiram, I think they'd like to see you.
Now, Dan'l, Hiram knows what he wants to do.
If he was up last night to see him, so my family's been represented.
Well, I think they'd like to see you, Hiram.
I hear Charles has got a haircut, Dan'l.
Why, Hiram.
If he said they had him cleaned up so good she didn't know him.
Oh, shucks, what's the use of palavering? See here, Hiram, I know you and Charles didn't speak for 3 years since you made that deal for the old Durkee place, but
I wasn't the one that carried the grudge.
Well, you're carrying it now. Go on up and see the family. It's the least you can do now. Charles is gone.
They don't want to see me.
Well, how do you know?
They think I swindled him on that trade.
Oh, Hiram.
Yes, young Charles said so in the post office not 2 weeks ago. When I come up to him and asked him how his father was getting along.
Well, you know that young Charles is a chip off the old block. I ain't speaking of him, but there's Miss Willis and the girls.
Hey, Kellett, they don't want my sympathy.
Oh, now, Hiram.
Dan'l.
Well, I got to get back to work.
Here, now don't go like this. Hiram.
Get up.
Oh, dear Hattie. You know, I hate to see him carry on a grudge after a man's dead.
It's his conscience, Dan'l, ain't yours?
Well, I guess you're right. Well, he trimmed Charles on that deal. He got 60 acres, and Charles got 2 horses that died in 4 weeks. Hiram knew they weren't sound when they let him go. You know, Hattie, that's the first time Charles was ever took in a trade. I think that's what killed him, brooding over it. Get out there. Go on with you. Say, Hattie.
What?
No, I can't get over him having a haircut.
You know, I as I hear this, Parker, I come to the conclusion that you were a premature old man. Is that...
Yes, I was born old.
Well, how did you develop this this character who over the years has assumed many names, but the voice is always so familiar?
Well, as I say, I came from a small town in Maine, and I think the way of speaking is pretty much the way I used to hear people of my father's generation talk. You know, somebody said to me when I was in Hollywood last, and there are no Hicks anymore, and that's pretty much true, because in the old days, you know, a man, a boy might be born, or a woman, born in a small town and never go out of the town until the day she died.
Mm-hmm.
But on account of the war, the World War I and World War II and the present war, these young boys have been all over the world. And consequently, the speech and the idiosyncrasies of the way they form their sentences, everything has been altered. And there aren't many... old-timers anymore who talk the way that I do. You know, in the old days, I seem to use that phrase quite a lot. In the old days, the word R-O-A-D, you know, going down the road, I don't think anybody, except somebody who was born to it, can pronounce it the way that we used to in the days when I was young. The older people always said road, which is impossible to spell, road. I mean, you see it in print, and you see sometimes people write it R-U-D, rud, but that isn't it, road. It's a very, very strange pronunciation, but that's all past history, and it doesn't mean anything to the younger generation or the middle-aged generation because they don't know what you're talking about.
Well, it's a type of American humor or folklore, which I think is probably never been duplicated by anyone else, that catching the spirit of America at the turn of the century, as you did in those shows.
We'll get back to the story of Parker Fennelly right after this.
Burritt Mutual Savings Bank asks you this question. Why should you save? Burritt Mutual Savings Bank will also try to answer. The reasons for saving are almost endless. One, it can open the door to your new home. Two, it can give you the means to new furniture, a new car, a boat, a vacation. Three, it can help send your children to college. Four, it can give you that glorious feeling of independence and prosperity. Don't ever feel that you have to have large amounts to save. At Burritt, deposits as small as $1 are welcome, really welcome. Start now and save for all these reasons and perhaps some of your own. If you can't save a lot, save a little. At Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, where deposits are safe and earn good dividends. Start your account tomorrow.
Member of FDIC.
Parker Fennelly is our guest. Perhaps it would be fair to say, Ed, that we're Parker's guests tonight.
Yes, we're actually in his dining room here doing the broadcast, and it's really great to talk about this show because it is one of my favorites, and I thought maybe we'd do a second excerpt from the show.
You know, I have never heard Snow Village excerpts before, sketches, and we're going to hear one of those excerpts right now.
Yes, I would like to lay the scene just a little bit. This one here, there is a woman who is playing the part of a small boy. And this is a story about fishing, and they say that the boy is played by a woman, but Parker is featured quite prominently in this sketch. So why don't we go back to the old days in Maine and see how it was, Dick.
This is a story of a trout and a truant and of late spring fishing madness. At least, Hattie called it madness when it's happened with great frequency. Dan'l dragged in with wet feet an hour late for supper, or at dawn, woke the house with his rising and the clumping of his boots before the mists were off the fields, or even the early rising hens had left their roost. But today, Dan'l was not fishing. There had been a little planting that could not wait, and the river was low and the day hot. And now the planting was done. Nor did Dan'l, as usual, seize his rod and make a beeline for the river. No, he stood at the shed door, a rather stern figure, gazing down into the face of a small boy, who listened, shifting from foot to foot.
Now, see here, Herbie, you pay attention to me.
Yes, Mr. Dickey.
I lent you my shovel to dig them worms. You was going off and leave it sticking there in the ground.
Oh, I forgot.
Yeah, well, now, that ain't no excuse, Herbie. Well, here, give it to me.
Yes, sir, and thank you, Mr. Dickey.
Well, I'm glad you got your manners with you, son. Now, remember, don't you keep no short trout.
Me?
Yes, you. You're 12 years old, Herbie. That's old enough to begin to obey the law.
I ain't 12 till August.
Well, mind you now. Here, Herbie, come on through the shed. Aunt Hattie's got some donuts laid out on the kitchen table. Let's try them, huh?
No, I'll just go this way through the fields. I ain't hungry. Goodbye.
Oh, I declare. First time I ever seen a Pettingill refuse food. Something funny. Well, I'll just try them myself here. Oh, Hattie, well, donuts, huh?
Dan'l, what you been telling that young'un?
Oh, obey the law, like I've been telling his father for 20 years. Maybe if I started on this one early enough to...
Why'd he come here?
Oh, I wanted to get some worms.
You know what day it is.
Huh?
It's Monday.
Well, what of it?
It's a school day.
Oh, wait. So it is. Well, well.
That boy ought to be over with the rest of the scholars a-learning something.
Why, ain't the truant officer. That's Hiram Neville's job. Say, why don't you put some sugar on these donuts?
Oh, don't try to change the subject, Dan'l, Dickie.
Yeah, come in.
I'll finish when company goes.
Hello there, Dan'l.
Well, Hiram.
Eddie.
Hi, Hiram. Well, sit down, Hiram. Sit down, stay a spell. Here, light your pipe. Have a donut. Spend the day.
You crazy?
Eat, eat.
I ain't got no time. I'm on town business. Yes, sir. Where's young Herbie Pettingill?
Huh?
I know he turned in here. Josh Ricker see him. Where is he?
Why, he's gone fishing, Hiram.
Ah, I knew there's some worthless good-for-nothing loaferish business.
Oh, well, now, hold on.
Which way to go?
Oh, light your pipe, Hiram.
He's a truant, Dan'l, and I'm going
to
get him.
It's wicked of Dan'l to excuse Herbie. He'll just go the way his father did, Hiram. And you'll be to blame, Dan'l, Dickie.
Oh, fool.
Well, if you won't tell me which way he went, I'll get along and hunt for him till I find him. And what's more, Dan'l, Dickie, I'll have a word to say to Warden Powell over to Conway about how his deputy encourages truancy.
Yeah.
I tell you, I'm sick of warning them Pettingill.
Oh, now, Hiram.
Good day to you, deputy.
Three hours later, his clothes torn by brambles, his face and hands scratched, unutterably wet and weary after a fruitless search along the riverbanks, truant officer Hiram Neville is proceeding home. He reaches the covered bridge and slows down in the grateful shade. What is that down yonder? Who is that figure almost out of sight, perched precariously below him on the masonry of the bridge?
Hey, you! You, Herbie! I see you. You can't get away from me. Come up here.
Nice day, ain't it?
I'm telling you to come up here, sir.
I'm fishing, Mr. Neville.
If I dare to let go, I could reach down and grab a hold of you.
You look awful funny hanging on there. You'd make an awful splash if you fell in the river. You'd scare the fish.
Oh, would I now? Well, that would be too bad. Because I see a way that I can get down to you. Maybe you'll be the one that's going into the river. Yes.
I look out. There ain't going to be room enough for us both down here. Look out, I tell you.
I'll get you if I get there. Yeah, didn't think I could make it, did you? Surprise you, huh? Well, I'll show you.
What are you grabbing my shoulder for? Let go of that rod.
I'm going to use the rod where it'll do the most good, you truant.
Huh?
Thought you'd sneak out of going to school and go fishing, you worthless little loafer.
I wasn't feeling very good today, and being closed up makes my headache worse.
Just as slick and glib as your father, ain't you? Well, you climb up on that bridge now. And I'm going to have a session with you.
Oh, Mr. Neville.
Go on, climb up there. And mind you don't run away or I'll catch you and I'll make you burn for it. Go on now and climb. And don't kick me in the face when you're about it either. Come on now, get.
Oh, gee.
No sniveling now. I'm going to learn you that the law is the law. And school is your job, sir.
Give me my rod, you mean old cuss.
No cussing me now. I'd give you a lick across the legs for that if I wasn't afraid of losing my balance here.
I want my rod!
Yeah, well, you ain't gonna get it. I'll hold the rod. I ain't gonna have you lighten out for them alders. And if you do skip, I tell you, you won't never get it again. Now climb up there.
All right. Mean, that's all you'll be. Just plain cussing.
Turn your back talk. You up there?
Yes.
All right. I'm coming up there now. And you stay there. I ain't making no bargains with you. Here, keep your feet still up there. Don't kick them chips off my face.
Mind, you ain't gonna lift me.
You stand still now. Here, reach down and give me a hand.
So you can come up and tan me?
I could get up if it wasn't for this cussed rod. Well, I'll lay it down here. You can get it when I'm through with you.
If you lose that rod, you'll pay for it.
Get your feet out of the way. I want to put my hand there. You're stepping on my fingers. Move your foot, Herbie, son. Move.
Awful nice day, ain't it?
Herbie, you're standing on my hand. Move your foot.
You're looking awful well, Mr. Neville.
You young devil. Get your hoof off of my fingers. Herbie, sonny, will you quit?
All right, now, we've heard the excerpt. Parker, who was the actress?
Playing the boy. Well, to the best of my recollection, it was Madeline Pierce. I cannot be 100% sure, but I would think so.
Well, we'll get back to the story of Parker Fennelly right after this.
How much should you save? The friendly folks at the Big B, Buried Mutual Savings Bank, generally say that you should have 6 months' pay in savings. Once reached, your savings goal will depend upon both the wants and needs of your family. Children need $10,000 or thereabout to finance college. Or perhaps your goal is the down payment for a home, money for a more comfortable retirement, or a new car. Don't wait another day. Stop in at Main, Slater Road, Corbin's Corner, or Weather Rock offices of the Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. With passbook savings from 5% to certificates of deposit as high as 6%. The savings people at the Big B have a program tailored to fit your specific needs. So don't wait. Make a date at Burritt Mutual Savings Bank.
Member of FDIC. You're listening to the Golden Age of Radio, brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. This is 1080 Radio, WTIC in Hartford, Connecticut.
Parker, we're talking about your career tonight, and there's much more to it, of course, than Snow Village sketches. So perhaps you can tell us better than we know, certainly, when you began to move into other areas of radio broadcasting.
Well, simultaneously with doing Snow Village sketches, Arthur Allen, who was my partner on Snow Village sketches, and I had a series for Swift and Company in Chicago. The Stebbins Boys was on 5 weeks, and we used to do 3 broadcasts a night, one broadcast for the coast and one for the Middle West and one for New York.
I suppose they didn't have tape.
That's right.
They had to do the shows live because there was no way of recording them other than on disc.
I presume that's right.
Was this show set in New England, too, the Stebbins Boys, or was
yes,
that something different?
Yes,
this was
yes.
Somewhat carry on the
it
tradition.
It was about two brothers who had a village store.
Oh, you mean like Lumen Abner, huh?
Yeah, well, I must
like
tell
that.
You that. And then you brought up something now. My wife used to belong to a garden club in which one of the members was a very deaf old lady, and I don't suppose she ever listened to radio. Probably couldn't hear it unless it was turned way up. But anyhow, she wanted to say, whenever she saw my wife, she wanted to say, you know, the right thing. She knew I was in radio. And so she said more than once to my wife, "I always forget, is your husband Lum or Abner?"
Well, now, how did you feel as an accomplished actor about doing one character all the time, Parker?
Well, there are thousands of actors who could do young, straight parts and dialogue. I could never do a dialogue like a foreign dialect. I never could do that. And I felt that I could do what I was doing better than some, or as well, at least. And so I stuck to it, and they stuck to me, the people who had that kind of a character who put on the air.
So a casting director, then, would in a sense, automatically think of you when they had a part for a New England old-timer.
Yes, that's true. I talked with a woman in 20th Century Fox Pictures 2-3 years ago, and I said, "This part, you can get 100 actors to play this part." And she said, "No, that isn't true. When actors get to your age," this was 3 or 4 years ago, "they either die or retire." And so there aren't so many around. But, of course, I've been playing old men since I was young.
Mm-hmm. Well, Parker, were you based basically in New York, or did you work in Hollywood as well in your radio days?
No, I didn't go to Hollywood until the latter part of my radio days. Percy Kilbride, who was an old friend of mine and had done the Pa Kettle part in Ma and Pa Kettle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Percy decided to retire, so they sent for me to come on, and I did the last Ma and Pa Kettle picture.
I've seen it.
I'm sorry about that. I never have. I heard it's one of the worst.
Well, it was one of the last, I know that.
Yeah, it was the last. And soon after Columbia Pictures came near going into bankruptcy, and I always...
It wasn't your fault, Parker.
It was their fault in putting me into it, because, as you know, Percy was a small man, slight man, very small. But it was, the audience didn't know what they were seeing, you see. Here's a new Pa Kettle, which is nothing like the old one. And so I'm sure it was a terrible failure. I know it was. But that was the first one I did in Hollywood. And then I did some for Louis de Rochemont here in the East, and I did one for 20th Century Fox here in the East with Doris Day called, made in Connecticut, by the way, where you come from, called It Happened to Jane.
That's right. Yes, as a matter of fact, I believe a WTIC remote truck appears in that film, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised.
John Gibson was in it, too.
Yes, and by the way, I just read that he died.
Yes, John was a guest about a year ago on the Golden Age of Radio.
He was a nice person.
A delightful person. Parker, What was a typical day or week for you like during those hectic days? How active were you?
Well, we have lived here over 40 years, and so consequently, I commuted from here sometimes 7 days a week and had to be in, as I remember, by 9 in the morning often, sometimes earlier and sometimes later. And at one time when I did a late broadcast of the Sebbins Boys for the West Coast, I lived in New York and the family lived out here. But I often worked for 7 days a week through many seasons.
I can imagine.
Yes.
We'll get back to the story of Parker Fennelly right after this.
Buying a new car in 1972? If so, bank credit may cost you less. At Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, we offer low-cost, convenient auto loans. But we can do more than just put you on the road. We help you establish credit with a bank. We give you cash buyer leverage, and above all, you either start or continue a relationship with a large and progressive mutual savings bank. Once your credit is established, you may want to purchase a new home, improve your existing home, or take a personal loan to finance your trip across the country. Whatever your borrowing needs, it will pay you to start doing business with the Big B, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. Once an established Burritt customer with good credit, you become a preferred Burritt borrower. So don't wait. Come into any office of the Big B, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank.
Ed, you've come up with another show that Parker was featured in that I don't recall.
Yes, it's a show called Mr. Feathers, and this is probably just a little bit different characterization than the role he played in the Snow Village Sketches, where he plays a man maybe middle age rather than old age, as was portrayed in the earlier sketches. Do you remember the show at all, Parker, how long it was on and everything, Mr. Feathers?
I don't remember exactly how long it was on, but it was on a good many months, I would say, at WOR.
Okay, why don't we listen to it now then, Dick?
All right, here it is, and it's called...
Mr. Feathers.
Mutual presents Parker Fennelly as Mr. Feathers.
Well, yes, I believe that when any gentleman sees a poor defenseless female in distress, he should notify the police.
It's Mr. Feathers and the woman in the case. Mr. Feathers, written by Gerald Holland and starring Parker Fennelly. Mr. Feathers, a man not quite like any next-door neighbor you ever had. Mr. Feathers at grips with life in the untroubled and quite untypical town of Pike City. Possibly the warmest admirer of Mr. Feathers in Pike City, with the obvious exception of Mrs. Feathers, is Norbert Corbett, the part-time delivery boy for the Pike City Pharmacy. Norbert is regarded locally as an amiable, normal young man, and it probably would require a Park Avenue, New York psychiatrist to find anything really complex about him. And yet, Norbert finds it increasingly difficult these days to maintain his emotional balance. Now, just where a psychiatrist would start in dealing with Norbert's problem is probably a Park Avenue trade secret. But he might very well start in the living room of Miss Emma Klaus, attractive daughter of the popular Pike City baker.
Oh, don't make me laugh, Mr. Corbett.
Oh, it's not my intention, Miss Klaus, to try for yachts in this connection. I'm dead serious.
You, a writer? Oh, don't make me laugh.
Well, I consider myself as much of a writer, and possibly more so than Mr. Philo Dolan.
Really? Well, there's just one slight difference, Mr. Corbett.
Namely?
Namely that Mr. Philo Dolan happens to be the editor of the Pike City High School yearbook.
A position obtained by pull, if I may say so.
Oh, to what pull do you have reference, may I ask?
I have reference to the pull of his uncle. Namely, J.P. Dolan, who's a member of the school board and takes a full-page ad in the yearbook and has also political connections. And furthermore...
Oh, don't make me laugh, Mr. Corbett.
I got talent. I got plenty of talent. All I need is for someone like a man of the world who gets what I'm driving at in my stuff. All I need is for someone like that to take me in hand and give me direction.
Who, for instance? Yes, who?
Well, somebody like... Well, like Mr. Feathers.
Mr. Feathers at the drugstore?
Why not?
Oh, don't make me laugh, Mr. Corbett. Mr. Feathers!
Mr.
way it is, Mr. Feathers. Miss Emma Klaus just don't understand me.
Why, I wouldn't worry about that, Norbert.
But the trouble is that...
Excuse me, Norbert. Pike City Pharmacy, Mr. Feathers. Why, Gabriel Heater. Radio survey. No, Norbert, no. The fact that the Klaus girl don't understand you is nothing to worry about.
No?
No. In fact, the smarter a man is, the fewer people understand him. Nobody understands Mr. Albert Einstein, do they?
Well, no, sir.
And you take my Uncle Weed. Now, he was a very smart man. Nobody understood him.
Is that so, Mr. Feathers? What line of endeavor did your Uncle Weed follow? My remark ludicrous, Mr. Feathers?
No, but it was just that, strictly speaking, Uncle Weed didn't follow no line of endeavor after the age of 40. You see, what happened was, Uncle Weed, he bought a radio. It was a tube set. He wouldn't have a crystal set in the house. Oh. That was because his hands used to shake in the morning and he just couldn't adjust the cat's whisker.
Oh, I suppose radio was quite crude in them early days.
Oh, yes, yes. You didn't have none of your refinements like today. I mean, there was none of your Queen for a Day or People are Comical programs. And no jackpots whatsoever.
There wasn't?
No, sir. And, of course, the soap story programs, they was just in their infancy. The young widow Brown had just buried her husband. John just had the one wife. And one man, he not only didn't have a family at that time, he wasn't even engaged to be married.
Golly, I guess that goes way back.
Well, sir, Uncle Weed, he sat listening to the radio. That was the new one with the tube set. He sat listening steady day and night for a month. Then he calls me into his room. He switches the tube set over to soft music by the A&P Gypsies. And he says to me, boy, he says, I think that I've hit onto something here.
Yes, sir. Mr. Feathers, you think maybe I ought to tell Miss Clark...
Boy, says Uncle Weed, radio is the greatest invention of the age. Boy, he says, I've been listening to these stories on the radio, and I think I've deciphered the message that they mean to convey.
Well, I guess I'd better be getting started on my deliveries.
What message do you have reference to, Uncle Weed, I says, if you'll excuse the interruption? Always speak your mind, boy, says Uncle Weed. You never miss your pocket watch until you're asked the time of day. He was a great one for dropping little nuggets of philosophy like that.
Well, golly, I don't see...
Boy, says Uncle Weed, if these radio stories are any indication, the big thing from now on is going to be people going around helping others. Well, I put my head back on the antimacassar and I let that sink in. Don't you see, boy, he says, with gentlemen like David Harum, Bill the Barber, and Scattergood Baines, with folks like them plugging the idea, he says, it's bound to catch on. And with more and more people starting in to help others, what, he says, is going to be the result?
I don't
Uncle
see what...
Uncle Weed, I says, what is going to be the result of all these people helping others?
Well...
Boy, says Uncle Weed, I foresee a great scarcity of others. And therefore, boy, he says, I'm quitting work, as of now, he says, and devoting the rest of my life to being another. Get the bathtub plant on the wire, he says. I'm sending in my resignation.
Golly, was he out of work the rest of his life, Mr. Feathers?
Uncle Weed never turned his hand again, Norbert. He became another.
What the...
Now then, have I answered your question, Norbert?
Well, yes, sir, you sure have. Still and all, Mr. Feathers, I don't see how I can apply this philosophy to my problem, which is how to be a writer and impress Miss Klaus.
Excuse me just a minute, Norbert. Pike City Pharmacy, Mr. Feathers. Why, Dewey. What? No. George E. Dewey, the Navy man. Someday that Dr. Gallup is going to run out of questions.
Well, that's a new one on me. Ed, you surprise me because of your recollection, perhaps due in part to your fabulous collection. I don't know.
Well, you listen to it so often, it's not 20 years ago. It's just like yesterday, so it makes a difference in your recall, Dick.
When was Titus Moody created?
Well, I remember doing a part in a program, I think it was an hour program, in which Fred was the MC, or at least he was very prominent in it.
We're talking about Fred Allen.
Fred Allen, yes. And in it there was a character, a rural character, which I did, and I had an idea that he may have sort of wanted to sound me out to see if he wanted me for the alley. Anyhow, with the alley, he had... Senator Claghorn, Kenny Delmar, Minerva Pius, Mrs. Nussbaum, Ajax, Cassidy, Peter Donald, and myself, Titus Moody. And I was with him three seasons of radio and one half season of television. He didn't like television, and it wasn't successful, and he abandoned it in the middle of the season.
All right. Tell us about Titus Moody. Who was he? What was the philosophy of the character?
You see, Fred was from Boston, and he liked the New England character, and he had a great deal to do, I'm sure, with writing it. I think Titus was a man who had a sharp wit, and he was tight-mouthed. He didn't give out too much, but he generally got the best of the argument. You know? I mean, he had the payoff of the joke, sort of.
As I recall, it would reflect what was prominent in the news at the time.
Oh, yes, right? Yes. That's right. Fred would take some subject from the news and then ask the different people of the alley their views on it.
And so our question tonight is, how do you feel about Mayor LaGuardia's return to private life?
Shall we go?
As the man said when he saw the lighted cigarette on the floor, let's step on it. Gosh, Portland, it's good to be back in Allen's Alley. Well, let's see what Titus Moody is up to tonight.
Howdy, Bob.
Say, Mr. Moody, you look shorter tonight.
First time I ever wore a union suit and stockings.
Well, what makes you look shorter?
It's trying to keep up my stockings.
Your stockings?
Yeah. This little door hangs down on the back of the union suit. And when I button that door onto my stockings...
Yes?
It pulls me down 6 inches.
It'll do it every time. Well, Mr. Moody, what do you think about Mayor LaGuardia leaving office?
Why, he's been a good mayor, what there is of him.
Well, what kind of work do you think he should go in for?
He'd be a good man on a farm, Bub.
Well, how do you mean?
He's the only man I know that can milk a cow standing up.
Tell me, Mr. Moody, do you think the mayor is sorry to go?
Oh, I know just how he feels, Bub.
You do, huh?
Yeah, I used to be mayor in my town.
You were the mayor?
Yeah, but I wasn't no LaGuardia.
You mean...
After working around a farm for 30 years...
Yes?
I didn't smell like no little flower.
It's too bad Mr. Moody isn't sheriff. He could pinch himself and see if he's awake. Well, let's see what happens at this next house. Ah, Mrs. Nussbaum. Tell me, Mrs. Nussbaum, how do you feel about Mayor LaGuardia retiring from City Hall?
I'm writing about Mayor LaGuardia a farewell poem.
A farewell poem. How does your ode to the mayor go?
I'm reciting it.
Fine.
The time is coming, Fiorello, to saying goodbye to you. For 12 long years in office, progress was your goal. But there is yet a housing shortage, and the subway is still in the hole. On your radio program Sundays, you were in a fighting mood, cracking down on gamblers and bookies, shouting patience with fortitude. You explained to us the OPA, told us bargains to get by Macy, gave recipes for pasta fazool. You also read Dick Tracy. The city hall you are leaving, to you our hats we doff. Goodbye, dear Mayor LaGuardia. Good luck and mazel tov.
As the sun slowly sinks behind our beloved mayor, we say adieu to City Hall and turn to the five DeMarco sisters. The girls, accompanied by Maestro Al Goodman and his Sanitation Department Symphony, sing Let It Snow.
Oh, boy, that really takes me back. Takes me back to the days of my youth.
It was a great show, and as I say, it was household words, all the characters on that particular show.
And there's one particular joke that I want to ask you about, Parker, but we're going to take time out for this first.
How do you glamorize a Burritt Mutual Savings Bank savings account? You can't use Hollywood adjectives such as glamorous, stupendous, magnificent, or such. What does describe such a Burritt account? Perhaps steady, dependable, reliable. Not much to shout about, probably, but there when you need it type of assurance. At Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, the safety of your savings is guaranteed by large surplus funds, insurance to $20,000 by FDIC, an agency of the U.S. government, plus a history of good service back to 1889. You get the highest legal interest at Burritt as well. Save where your money is safe and earns good dividends at Burritt Mutual Savings Bank.
Well, Parker, every time someone recalls the character Titus Moody, they come up with a particular line concerning the radio. Do you recall that?
Oh, I think Fred asked me when he called at my house in Allen's Alley if I enjoyed the television. And I said that I never held with furniture that talked. I think that was the line.
Well, now, as spokesman for Pepperidge Farms, Parker, I understand that you have a routine that you do at sales meetings. Am I right?
I appeared as a mystery guest. I wasn't supposed to be around, and they suddenly brought me in. And as I remember it, when something like this, why, I can't stop but just a minute. I'm pretty busy. I come down here to fetch my father down to a convention, the Century Club. I guess you all know about the Century Club. All the members are 100 years old. They don't do much at these conventions. Well, at 100, what can you do? Mostly they just sit around wishing they was 98 again. Pretty dull. I tell you, when a man gets to be 100, he's been where he's going. But I tell you, it's anniversary week for me and Miss Moody. 40 years been married. Never had a word. I didn't, anyway. I give her anniversary present, $2. She sat right down, sent away to Susan Roebuck for a dress. Easy come, easy go. I kind of wish she was here sometimes, because I've been hearing a lot of this nice music on this radio business. We don't have them up home, you know. Both of us is musical. Matter of fact, it was on account of music that me and Miss Moody got married. Snavely, her name was them days. Calpurnia Snavely. We used to go around singing together back then. You know, giving concerts. We used to sing at croquet games and hog slaughterings, social functions like that. One night, I guess I'll never forget that night. It was a bright moonlight night. I was fetching her home in the buggy. We'd been singing at a balloon ascension. I drove her up to the end of her father's driveway. It was about half a mile from the house. Old man was a dead shot in them days, and I was helping her out of the buggy, and some way or other, she kind of tottered and lost her balance, and in the fracas, I catched a glimpse of the top button of her gaiter. Well, I done the right thing, I married her. Friday the 13th, George.
That's funny. Parker Fenley, I certainly have enjoyed meeting you and recalling the wonderful memories of your career in the golden age of radio, and I thank you for that personalized performance tonight.
I was going to tell you, as long as Arthur Allen and I were doing Snow Village sketches, we used to get letters or cards semi-occasionally from a very nice, as it turned out, a very nice little woman in Connecticut. She followed us through many seasons, and we got a card from her saying that she was going to visit her daughter in New Jersey and was coming over, or could she come over, and see one of the broadcasts. There's nothing duller than seeing a radio broadcast, especially in a small studio. But we asked her to come, and she arrived, and then she stayed in the control room for the program. And here was this little woman. She was a very tight-lipped little New England woman who had been listening to us for many, many years and had evidently pictured the town hall and the covered bridge and all the rest of the small-town New Hampshire life. And we took her out to the elevator, and all she said about what she'd seen and heard, I should think you'd be bored to death doing this.
Well, we certainly haven't been bored to death tonight. And Parker Fenley, thank you so much for
I'm very glad
sharing your memories with us. Ed, it's been great fun.
Yes, to meet really one of my all-time favorite actors. It's really been great, Dick. No
and, of course, we're going to be back on next month, and we'll have another exciting show, I'm sure, for our listeners. So until then, this is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
Tonight's program has been brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, serving Central Connecticut since 1889. The Golden Age of Radio is produced and edited by Brian Hartnett. Location recording engineer, Ben Zinkerman. Technical supervision by Robert Schirago. This is Al Terzi.
You know, Charles, many's the time I wish you could be here to fill that terrible vacancy.
In your heart, Mr. Fields?
Oh, in my fireplace.
Hit the spot. 12 full ounces, that's a lot. Twice as much for a nickel, too. Pepsi Cola is the drink.
Good evening, friends of the Inner Sanctum. This is your host, the Welcome.